Let me turn then to a brief introduction of to Jonathan Zittrain, our keynote this morning. You know, spending time with Jonathan is fun. When it comes to the technology intelligentsia, there are few people who have their feet firmly planted on the ground, and Jonathan, I'm proud to say, is one of them. While he has a deep understanding of technology, he has no illusions about technology being some sort of panacea. He's conducting some absolutely fundamental work at Harvard on how internet technology, societal norms and law interact in a volatile mix sometimes. And maybe he's become what's been coined a techno-realist because he's been at it so long. I'll invite you to ask him to tell you the story about how he managed to speak to 1,100 or so people at Texas Instruments when he was 14. Jonathan has really splendid credentials. He has a B.S. summa cum laude from Yale's Cognitive Science and Artificial Intelligence School, a J.D. magna cum laude from Harvard, an MPA from the John F. Kennedy School of Government. He's now the executive director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, and speaking from the perspective of someone who's had the privilege of watching him in action in this classroom, he's a great teacher. Please welcome Jonathan Zittrain.
Thank you, Dominic, and good morning, everybody. For all those credentials, perhaps the one I should wear, if not proudly, somewhat with trepidation, is that of a member of the technology intelligentsia, because when the technology proletariat rises up, I hope that they are generous to me in the coming bad years. I hope that my discussion today will help assuage the fears of anybody who identifies with the latter group and even help build a bridge between them. So again, thank you, Dominic. I'm struck by the fact that there is a Wired Law Office just down the hall, and I suppose as all of you heard about its existence and thought about what it's going to look like when you go down the hall to check it out, will it be with fear or love that you sit down in it? When you sit down in the chair and you see all these keyboards and programs and case management systems and everything else facing you, are you going to worry a little bit that you're behind the times and that somebody else is actually running this stuff and you're not? Or are you going to be so excited that they've actually got a Pentium 2 processor and you could have one of those too and happily enter the lottery, perhaps to win a free one if there is such a thing? I'm not promising. I don't know anything about this. So today, I am charged with giving you sort of the big picture overview. And by big picture, I mean that metaphorically. You'll notice that there are at least two big pictures on either side. There will be nothing displayed there, if I can help it, during the duration of my speech. I understand to make up for that, Terry Redder has a 22-megabyte presentation. I'm not sure if that's just one big, really highly rendered picture or a series of slides, but at some point, the investment that's been made in these big pictures will no doubt come to roost. So that said, when Dominic and I were talking about exactly what to title this presentation and what it should focus on, we settled on law and a connected world because it's wonderfully ambiguous. It's ambiguous in the sense that it can at least mean two things. The first thing is, as lawyers, how do we practice in a connected world? What does it mean for our law offices and our firms to actually have all this technology at the ready and to be in a position to want to deploy it or to worry that others are about to? Secondly, what are the legal challenges coming from this new connected world? If you're in a law practice and you're interested in getting into so-called cyber law, a field that I might add is on somewhat beginning ground right now, what challenges await and what opportunities are there? And I hope today to talk about both these subjects here at the inaugural LawTech conference. I might as well start the habit of calling it LawTech 99. That suggests, if not that there was a LawTech 98, that there will be a LawTech ot or 00. I'm not sure how you would say it here or anywhere for that matter. But again, thank you for the opportunity to be here. So let's start with law with a connected world. What the challenges are for the law office. And I've kind of tried to break down the various trees I'll point out from this bird's eye view into the little issues and to the bigger issues. And by little issues, of course, I don't mean to say that they're not important, just that they are, in some ways, more immediate. They're the ones that are sufficiently right in front of us that there've already been some thought by people as to how to address them. And a lot of these thoughts you'll hear over the course of today and tomorrow. So what are some examples? First, there's the little issue of cost structure. Is there any way in which how you make money at a law firm, should you be in private practice, how will that change in a connected world? I remember actually being at a big Washington law firm as a visitor and discussing with one of the attorneys the fact that they had just finally gone on email. And at some point he let slip the fact that they actually charged their clients per email. So should an email be sent, you would designate in another field as to what case it pertained, and then a dime or 15 cents would be charged to the client's account. I said, that's interesting. You must have a bizarre email system that racks up charges for you like that, such that you have to pass them along. He said, no, not at all. You know, we have a fixed cost. We have to pay for it somehow. And he said, besides which, if we actually had stuck with paper, we'd have to Xerox each sheet to send a memo around to the same team, and that's money that is going on to be charged to the client. So why should the client capture all of the cost savings of going to email? I'm not sure if the clients are still happily paying 10 or 15 cents per email on a given case, but it certainly does raise questions as to how the structure of our practices may change as we adopt particular technologies. Of course, there are other issues as well. I think something you'll hear a lot about over today and tomorrow will be security. As you've happily adopted new technologies such as email, what obligations do you have, or better put, what do you need to be up at night worrying about such that people may be able to listen in on the communications in some way you haven't made the email perfectly secure, and as a result, what you thought was very highly privileged and confidential communications have ended up in the recycling bin either outside the law firm or outside some other firm that had business with you and was looking to read your email. There is something interesting in that I've seen some law firms have this confidentiality notice at the beginning or end of an email. I guess this started with faxes. Occasionally the cover page says, you know, this is a highly confidential document designed for the designated recipient only. If you are not the designated recipient, you're hereby notified that you must shred it into tiny pieces and throw it away and forget that you ever got it and then call us and tell us that you got it and send it back. And I've seen some of these notes actually adapted towards emails as well. And there is this incongruity as the internet world meets the kind of stiff legal world, and you see an email with exactly a notice just like that, perhaps not with the shredding part, but then you see that it's addressed to, you know, bigmama@hotmail.com. And you realize that if not the client base is changing, that there's an informality of the communication that's unavoidable, coupled again with this sort of stiff, lawyerly prose. It's particularly interesting, too, if anybody here participates on mailing lists or Usenet groups, basically areas in which if you send a single email, you actually mean it for a large and unbounded group. You don't know who's going to see it, and yet the confidentiality notice is still tacked to the top. In those instances, here's a piece of practical advice. I would advise you to omit it, unless, of course, you are under some obligation not to that I haven't foreseen, in which case you're under your own liability rules, and I wish you well. Other issues. Well, learning to use and not to use the technology. I don't know how many people here consider themselves people familiar with the technology, and again, more on the love side than the fear side of dealing with it. But a really good question to ask ourselves as we adopt this stuff is, to what extent do we need to understand it or use it? How much can we just be satisfied knowing that somebody in the firm knows how to use it, and as long as we can go to that person who perhaps has now a propensity to hide, and find them and ask them questions or give them the particular thing to do that requires the technology, that has satisfied our own need to use it. And I want to suggest that there are reasons to want to be familiar with it. It has ramifications both for the practice and even substantively that if you're not immersed in it, it really is easy to lose. And of course, on the flip side, it's how not to use the technology. I remember in the Defense Department days in the United States, I credit part of the close of the Cold War, at least the balance between the respective countries there, to the fact that there was a game called Empire. I don't know if anybody has heard of this game or wants to admit having played it. This was developed by Defense Department contractors in their so-called spare time. It's a game in which you have various countries. It's up 24 hours a day, so you visit the game, and then when you leave, your country stays behind, and others who visit the game while you're away could be, for instance, attacking it, and then you have to go back and make sure that all of the automatic defenses you have set up are actually working. Many, many hours of time went into Empire, which were time that did not go into the development of missiles or anti-ballistic missiles or other technologies. And to that extent, I think the inefficiencies introduced by the system, and to my knowledge, it was never hooked up actually to the real missile defense network. But of course, we see some shadow of that today. If you look at Solitaire, now why the makers of Windows saw fit to include that particular game with it is unclear. But I remember at one time clerking for a judge, a United States federal judge, and come in, he had two secretaries because of the amount of work he had. I come in and I actually see both of them playing solitaire at the same time. I'm wondering if somehow you could link the computers together. Why don't they just play, you know, some kind of card game like Euchre that might require more people? And I might suggest, daring to make a prediction, that a future version of Windows, if not including Euchre, could include some other games. And actually dealing with the loss of efficiency that comes with just that one unit alone has occupied some research staff, thankfully not from my center. Okay, some bigger issues than solitaire. Well, one is telecommuting. This is something that's had promise for a long time, and the notion of people trying to get away from logging hours at the firm and actually being able to spend their time at home but also be productive at the same time, that's been around for a while, and with mixed results. The reports that you hear most of the time from those firms that have experimented with telecommuting are that, yeah, they can ship documents back and forth to people, but that somehow it's just not the same as being there. And that's true. Well, one suggestion that has come is that actually there's a social element that comes from being at the office. Now, this sounds quite obvious, right? There's a social element that comes to being at the office. And yet, those who devised the systems for telecommuting wouldn't think to incorporate a social element into those systems. Why, that would be including solitaire with the operating system, and we all know how bad that has become. Yet, for telecommuting to succeed, you might imagine that having some form of chat room, some form of area where you can blow off steam and send messages that may not have to be directed to a particular client or case that could be billed just to the firm for having that message, that would be something that might try to recreate in some way the connections that take place so informally around the office. At the very least, I think we're going to see continued pressure for people to be able to take their life on the road. We already know that if you happen to be onto email and using it frequently, if you happen to avoid it for several days, when you come back, there's an unpleasant surprise of several hundred emails waiting for you. And trying to find the plus side of telecommuting, actually have it be a more complete experience, is an issue I think we're all going to have to be working on. There are companies that have successfully had such programs, Microsoft not the least among them. And again, I credit in some ways the active social life that takes place in the cyber environment, such that you may not even be having as many in-person meetings, even if you are at the corporate campus. I credit that with a large part of their success. Another somewhat bigger issue. I don't know how many of you have ever seen or used the Quicken Family Lawyer. This is not a person. This is a CD-ROM, which you can put in your computer and gives you legal advice. The Quicken Family Lawyer has been charged in Texas with the unauthorized practice of law. I am not making this up. There's actually a federal district court in the United States that has banned sales of the Quicken Family Lawyer in the state of Texas. This is quite extraordinary for a number of reasons, the first of which that the legal profession may be coming to view itself as possibly replaceable by a CD-ROM. We know that that's not so. We can use the CD-ROMs and then produce the reports to hand off to our clients. But it suggests that there's an area where even the public at large is starting to get worried about the use of technology and where it fits into things. Another program adjunct to Quicken's Family Lawyer you may have heard of is TurboTax. Now, there's an interesting phenomenon I say is taking place with TurboTax, and that is, step one is it makes doing your taxes easier. It really does. It asks you a series of questions. You answer the questions on the basis of your answers. It asks you more questions. And at the end of the day, it prints out forms that you can't understand in the least. It tells you where to sign and tells you how much to make out your check for and how much to expect back from the government. Now, this is a good feature, at least to the client, who is able to use the software and come up with the right answers and not get audited, or if audited, be able to point to TurboTax as the reason why something might not be right. Of course, what's step two? Step two says we can make the tax laws somewhat more complicated, because after all, we've got TurboTax to sort through the various permutations and help us out. And you actually see a reaching phenomenon where, because you've got the software as the middle person to figure this out, you can have increasingly Byzantine rules that is then matched by the simplifying feature of the software that then amounts to some kind of resolution. I'm convinced that if people actually had to, for instance, I don't know if they have withholding here. It's a wonderful invention, again, in the tax arena, whereby you get a paycheck and it actually is net proceeds, of course. It's not what you really got paid. It's what you got paid minus what the government took out. If they didn't have that simple invention, and instead, on a given tax day, one had to go to the bank account and fork over thousands of dollars, there might be a revolution where today there is actually pleasure that, my God, I got something back from the government. How about that? I got a refund check. Similarly, if you imagine this phenomenon taking place of the reaching with TurboTax and other such software, you realize in the event the software goes away, people would be completely bemused as to how to actually sort through those different permutations. And in this sense, I suggest that as lawyers, it's our job to be the human element that actually still can understand as much as possible those twisting paths and not simply leave it in the hands of the software. In our own practices, this becomes clear when you think of software that helps you write contracts. I don't know if anybody has tried such software. You can answer a sort of questionnaire, and the efficiency argument for it is great. I mean, this has been done before. Why shouldn't you rely on contracts that have been perhaps even held up as good in court to serve as the basis of your own contracts? You go ahead, you write it, you answer the questions, it generates template, and away you go. But of course, the more template you can generate, the more template you can generate, which is to say, you answer some more questions, the contracts get longer and longer, you never particularly have cause to read them, and we end up trading documents that neither side has particularly vetted, and it may or may not reflect the understanding that the parties actually want to come to. So I at least want to suggest that to those of you who want to follow Texas's lead and actually worry about outlawing this stuff, there may well be reason to worry about it, as I've just said, in this reaching phenomenon, but there's no reason to think it's actually going to replace the human element. Another bigger issue. We still have today the primary form of legal argument, if not coming up before a microphone and saying things, the writing of a brief. You produce a document, it's so many pages, it obeys certain rules, you hand it in, and that's that. Now, I do think the day is getting closer in which the typical brief is going to be a multimedia presentation. You won't be able to get away with saying, by the way, I have nothing for the big picture, I'm just going to read from this prepared text. And being able to understand the technology is being able to say, what would the elements be in a multimedia brief? If I were telling the story I have to tell to this court to explain why my client is right and the other client is wrong, what elements of the story would come from video? What would come from audio? How would I splice it all together? In the United States, we've just had that experience in the United States Senate with multimedia presentations of all kinds. Luckily, no in-person demonstrations that I've seen, but all sorts of technology has been brought to bear with varying success to present the evidence. But there you saw a clear case of 100 people sitting down, very unused to not being able to say a word, having to listen to evidence being presented, and the people presenting it realizing it would be incredibly boring to simply get up and read a speech. You've got to have the visual aids. You've got to have as much media as you can come up with to present your case. Of course, what we converge to as a standard, given how long we've held on to the brief standard, we may worry that once we converge to the multimedia standard, it's going to be with us for a while. Another question to answer would be, what are the production values necessary to generate that brief? Is it the kind of thing that a small law firm, a sole practitioner, can expect to generate more or less, again from a production value standpoint, as good a brief as the next person? Or is it the kind of thing for which one firm is going to hire Lucasfilm to present its argument in a difficult patent case, and another firm is going to be stuck with the cable access channel people? Do you have cable access channel people here? please take ours. But the cable access channel people are going to help produce the other one. That, of course, does open up issues of equity that resound the same way that as legal databases have come about and have been charging very high prices per hour, questions of equal access even to search engines and to the cases have come about. Another bigger issue, and that is collaboration. Apart from just the kind of idea of one person being able to telecommute, is the idea of using this connectedness, not just the technology, but the fact that my computer is wired to everybody else's in a fairly interesting way, to collaborate on the presentation of a case. Now, I say, over the long haul, this may test the definition of just what a law firm is. The client who wants absolutely the best representation may be tired of having to choose between one firm and another when there are incredibly strong, perhaps the best lawyers, as far as it is concerned, dispersed between the two firms. How long might it be before you could imagine a working group of lawyers cutting across several firms saying, guess what, we have among ourselves assembled the best team for you to handle this case. Here's the best expert in civil procedure from this firm, coupled with the best antitrust person in the country at that firm, and together we're going to be the team that represents you. Now, there are ways in which the rules of professional conduct have not readily contemplated that these kinds of working groups could come about. To imagine having to worry about the possible conflicts spawned by 18 firms, each of which contributing one person, but having 400 in their respective offices, it would be very difficult to imagine those lawyers all in one room able to represent a particular client and to say it's being done without conflict across all the firms. But in the end, I think those rules are going to have to yield because the pressures will be so strong and the benefits, at least to that one client willing to pay top dollar, too great not to worry about crossing those boundaries. We see it too in the university context, in which you imagine not having to make a choice between one university and another should you wish to study in a long-term way somewhere, but rather imagining cobbling together a team of professors that's your sort of dream team of who might teach you from one university to the next. And just as universities are somewhat chary of this idea, I assure you, it's right for law firms to say, what is this transformation going to mean for us? The other way in which the collaboration could come about is with the sense of outside counsel. To the extent that a law firm has a tight relationship with a given company and there is work that needs to be done between the two, you can imagine that being able to readily interface, be it through email or through document sharing, is something that could be of great benefit to the client and something that sooner or later they're going to come to expect. Now, this means that if you were one of those law firms that were unlucky enough to be on the absolute cutting edge 15 years ago, and you've still got the vax in your basement to prove it, you may have to consider upgrading after all these years. It's time to say goodbye. You've got to get rid of the old tech, put in the new tech, or at least have some way of being able to say to a client, I see, you're in Xyrite format. You know, we can do that, I think, be able to take it back and figure out some way to parse the file. It may be harder than you think. Again, back to an example from Washington, the Starr report, as you may know, was rushed onto the internet. Ken Starr's team used WordPerfect, I think it was 5.1, and it was sent over to the Hill, which promptly loaded it into Word and then did a save as in HTML format. It's okay if you don't understand this. I'm not sure the Hill or Ken Starr did either, because what happened was footnotes that had been deleted from the report didn't actually go away. WordPerfect just marked them as deleted and remembered, but Word didn't quite realize that, and several versions of the Starr report in HTML contained these previously deleted, now sprung to life from the undead, footnotes, which included some actually quite interesting statements, including some internal jokes among Starr's team about the various witnesses. And it's actually an amazing statement about the American media that this is not a more widely known phenomenon. Perhaps I can hand out URLs to those who are interested as a bonus for attending the conference to see the missing footnotes. All of this together suggests a realm of openness that we are going to have to confront. And to think about this realm of openness, I suggest the following hypothetical. Suppose you are the IT manager of a fairly large company, and one of your sales rep leaders and managers calls in from the field. He's at an airport, and it turns out that his laptop has been stolen. You know, it went in through the x-ray, and it never came out the other side, and it doesn't seem to be in the middle. No more laptop. What do you do? And you think, oh, the first thing you think often is, oh, there goes $5,000. I got to call the insurance company and see what to do. And maybe I'll report it to airport security. Now, why do you report it to airport security? I don't know. You have no expectation that airport security is going to find this laptop. But then the second question is, all right, what was on the laptop exactly? And you start asking, perhaps, what was on the laptop? And it turns out that the merger plans with the other company that you'd been in intense discussions with, highly confidential, were on the laptop. Now what do you do? And you actually, as you think through this hypothetical, you go from thinking of it as a $5,000 loss, okay, we'll write it off, to starting to wonder, all right, now who has the plans? When was the thing last updated? What does he remember as having been on it? Did he encrypt the hard drive? Invariably the answer is no, he did not encrypt the hard drive. Now what do you do? What are your reporting obligations as a company to your respective jurisdiction Securities and Exchange Commission? What do you have to tell your potential merger partner as to the data that may be out there in the world now about the plans? Should this be on the CEO's desk so the CEO can make a decision about what to do? And you find yourself seesawing between this is no big deal and we've got to wake the CEO up in the middle of the night to alert them that the laptop has been taken. CEO's saying, yeah, a laptop's been taken, you know, what are you waking me for? And actually, figuring out how to deal with such things, I think, is one of the biggest challenges of this open environment. Now, your first instinct as you cast about for solutions, and you're thinking in your own mind, all right, here's what I would do on that, is to say, I'll make sure the hard drive is encrypted. Or at least in the next level to realize that the technical architectures that you choose to run your practice or your firm have actual relevance to the liabilities of your business. To realize that had it been a light client, and the fellow only had to log in and could view the various contracts on the screen, but they weren't saved locally to the hard drive, could have huge ramifications for the ultimate liability of the company in this instance. So then you start thinking about how can you tighten security? How can you kind of contract it? I guess the other thing to think about is, in the event that the arms race of tightening security as others are prying it open or it is unexpectedly failing in some way, the other way to think about it is, how might we operate in an open environment? What would it mean to actually go public slightly more prematurely with word of the merger? If you did so, wouldn't that cure the problem in that instance of this Damocles sword lingering somewhere out there with that information? We are doing, the Berkman Center, a study of our own on this that is not hypothetical. We've taken on a case called Eldred v. Reno. In it, we challenge the recent United States extension of copyright to bring it in harmonization with recent updates to the Berne Convention. And copyright in the United States originally was approximately 75 years. Not originally. Originally, it was 14 years. But then it got extended and got extended and got extended again. Now the duration of copyright was 75 years. And just last year, in the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act, introduced by his wife, Mary Bono, in which he said, I know that Sonny would have wanted copyright to be forever, but I've been advised by counsel that that may not be as possible, so we're settling for another 20 years. Copyright was extended for 95 years, and it was done so retroactively, so that existing materials under copyright now have another 20 years to them. Now, our claim is that this is actually a constitutional problem, because within the U.S. Constitution, enumerating the powers of Congress is the statement that to promote the progress of the useful arts and the sciences, one may secure for a limited time to authors and inventors their respective rights to their writings and inventions. So we say, all right, at some point it's no longer a limited time, enough is enough, so we try this case. But that's not why I'm telling you about the case, because the other thing we're trying is we figure this is a case about openness, about the public domain, about opening things up. So let's try litigating this case on the web. And we're actually sacrificing the traditional element of surprise and of focus that you get when you work in an obviously cloistered environment to produce a brief that you then serve with satisfaction on the other party. We're actually developing our brief on the web. And there's a public URL that you can go to. You can see the fragments of our thinking as we go. Now, the law firm we're working with to prosecute the case is somewhat, I wouldn't say skeptical, but I guess the right word is terrified of this approach, and have come up with a whole list of reasons why this is actually an enormously bad idea. We have forged ahead nonetheless. This is what you can do in public interest litigation, right? We have the full support of our client, a person who wants to take copyrighted works and put them up on the web, and there aren't zillions of dollars in sanctions at stake against us. So we can experiment this way, and I will be happy, perhaps, at LawTech, ought to report back on how the initial briefs are going, and within 10 years, I'm sure we'll have a full resolution of the case and some idea as to the advantages and disadvantages of having to litigate in truly an open environment. Another thing to think about in this environment, and this is another reason why it's worth trying to learn the technology, is the divide that exists between, I'll phrase it two ways. First, it's a divide between us and the techno-weenies, the people that actually know how to run the stuff and that are down in the bowels of the firm or wherever they may be, and they're the ones who, when you call them and say, I managed to have a bad sector on my floppy disk, I've lost the brief, can you help? They sort of look at you indulgently like you're about 4 years old. Yeah, you know, you should have made a backup, and you feel rightly shamed, and you want to be really nice to them, because if you're not, they might give you bad news. Everybody's nodding. Yeah, this is exactly how it happens. And there's definitely an allocation of power that is quite bizarre. While normally you wouldn't, I mean, it's always nice to be nice to people, don't get me wrong, but while normally you wouldn't have to walk on eggshells with the staff of the office such that they have it in their hands to ruin you if you don't do it quite right with them. And you'll never know if it was them ruining you or the software ruining you or something else that went wrong. This is the fear that comes from the wizardry that is behind the software, and a reason, if not to personally learn it yourself, to realize that it makes sense for those that are charged with making the decisions and bearing the responsibility within an organization to really have delegates among them, at least, that are understanding the technology and making decisions about it. Now, in all fairness to the techno-weenies, we could see it another way as well, which is to say, it's all of us, those, of course, sufficiently into the technology to attend a conference of this sort, versus those ignorant, unappreciative lawyers and other people who don't know what they're doing, who constantly, because they're just too careless or lazy to back up, come to us in the middle of the night with their stupid problems, and we then have to indulge them. And of course, that's another perfectly reasonable telling of the story. We're lawyers, we can see both sides. And to that, then, I would say, we as the techno-weenies, our responsibility is to realize that the decisions that we think may just be ones of efficiency. Should we do a distributed network or a heavy client where everybody has his own documents, or should we do something where it is stored centrally and then people log in? Those aren't just efficiency questions. As we discussed a few moments ago in the example of the laptop, decisions like that actually have ramifications for the way the firm might practice or the way the company might operate. Another example is backups. I mean, to somebody who is immersed in technology, the rule is backup, 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 and save the stuff forever if you can help it. You never know when you might need it. Now, to the lawyers in the audience, this can possibly be an absolute nightmare, because somebody serves you with a document production request. I want everything relating to the word blah that your firm may have talked about, that your client may have talked about. And the techno-weenies helpfully volunteer, hey, we could just run a search, take 5 minutes, I'll tell you every single email that mentioned that client. You sort of grit your teeth, you're like, thank you so much. You know, it took you 10 weeks to restore the file I lost, but suddenly it's 2 minutes to do a search for these documents. Now really, what do you do about that? I mean, backup is good, and if it's not that expensive to do, you'd imagine that more often than not you want to do it. But there really are conflicting thoughts with respect to your client when the client wants to be protected from legal liability, do so in an honorable way. They're not looking to cheat. They don't want to shred documents. But they say, tell me honestly, when can I get rid of these records? I have no reason to think I'm going to be sued, so should I ditch them? Should I not bother to back up after I feel they're no longer useful to me? Or even if they are useful, am I better off just sort of getting rid of the stuff when I can do so at the touch of a button and avoid problems later on? This came out especially so in a case called Armstrong v. Executive Office of the President. In the United States, there's a law that is alternately loved and hated called FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act. FOIA is something that allows you to demand of the government some particular information they may have, and as long as you can name it with specificity, the government has a presumption of having to give you the information or offer up one of several narrow exceptions as to why they can't. One of these was actually most notable when somebody back again in the tax arena wanted to know the formula by which the government would assign a value to each entry in a tax return, multiply, do certain transformations, and come up with a score that said how likely it was that the tax return was fraudulent. Through statistical manipulations of known fraudulent returns against known good returns, you can come up with a formula that says people who file fraudulent returns typically enter 1 million in this line and put a zero in that line, and therefore we know that it might be a problem and a candidate for auditing. So this person, who was actually known for dashing into government offices and hugging file cabinets and then saying, I FOIA this, and as she was hauled off for trespassing, actually would have lodged a FOIA request, having named the documents with sufficient specificity that the government would have to respond, FOIA'd the DIF formula, which was the formula that tells you what is an auditable return and what is not an auditable return. The government actually prevailed on grounds of national security as to why they would not release the DIF formula. But all this is to say that somebody went ahead and FOIA'd a bunch of emails out of the White House on the eve of Ronald Reagan's leaving office and saying, I want to see these emails. They are public records or federal records under as defined under the statute, and I want to see them. This case is actually still working its way through the courts. But it turned out at one critical juncture, a decision had to be made. The argument that was accepted by the courts and given by the government was, these emails aren't records, and here's why they're not records. They're not records because we ask our employees to either, if the email rises to the level of a record, print it out and put it into the regular filing system, or if it doesn't qualify under the statute as a record, they can ignore it. So therefore, the only emails that exist in the system are non-records, or records that have already been printed out and filed. And if they've been printed out and filed, the things in the email system are mere duplicates, and mere duplicates we don't have to produce. And that's true under the law. Well, it turned out that the printout omitted certain data. The data was who received the email and when. Now, some email systems don't feature this. Internet email does not typically have a return receipt feature implemented, so you don't know who got it and when. The email that the Executive Office of the President happened to have chosen did have this feature. And because of that, it's had wonderful smoking gun language, you know, you want to know who knew what and when, that was the data that is not captured by the printout. As a result, the printouts were not deemed to be legitimate copies of the original federal record email, and the emails were deemed to then be federal records. Now, that's a technological decision. You could imagine if they're tossing the old email system and coming up with a new one, one of the charges to the people generating the system may be, and by the way, enough with the date stamp. We don't need that feature. You know, we'll knock off $5 from the price of the system. Don't give us the feature, and we'll be very happy. In fact, charge us more not to have the feature, and we'll be very happy. And hopefully it's an illustration that shows that decisions about what technology to adopt are best made in collaboration between the people who know the technology cold and can tell you what will work and what won't and what's a security risk and what's not, and the people that have an eye towards the legal obligations, the legal responsibilities, and to be sure, the ways of minimizing legal responsibility. Finally, on this note, I want to say something about learning to say yes. People come to lawyers with tech-related questions, with internet-related questions especially, because they are uncertain. They don't know what to expect. And they're looking for certainty in a world in which we all know the rules have not yet been written. Or if they've been written, they're really written in plastic. They could change in a heartbeat. It's so hard for us as lawyers to be oracular about things, and yet that's just what is sought. Now, one of the typical reactions of a lawyer in this situation is to be conservative, is to say, well, I don't know, it's hard to say, and therefore the most prudent course would be to not particularly engage in this particular conduct that you think may expose you to liability. not to rely on a click wrap agreement, because it's not clear that just clicking I agree is enough to bind the person. So I'm sorry, if you're going to do electronic commerce, you've got to get a faxed or signed contract if it's anything big. And I guess I would suggest that while that is a perfectly sound line of argument, there are also trade-offs that have to be made. And to understand that perhaps the job of the lawyer is not simply to minimize liability, but to realize that minimizing liability as against conducting business and actually engaging in what look like fruitful opportunities is a balance that should be consciously struck. And it may mean that saying yes can happen more than one is used to. So often a deal in the fast-moving internet world is just coming together, the parties are loving it, they're already starting to carve up the pie that they're sure is about to be so huge, and one of them says, you know, we really got to figure out who's going to own what, let me call my lawyer. And of course at that point all work grinds to a halt, months go by while the lawyers start thinking about it and talking about it, and the deal does not go down and there never is a pie to be divided. Now, this doesn't mean that lawyers are bad. It just means that lawyers have a role in speeding things up as well as slowing things down in this environment. So in the couple minutes that I have left here, and I'd like to leave time for at least a couple questions, it's hard to see. Actually, there are these bright Klieg lights, but I think there's a microphone about 20 feet ahead of me. And if so, that's where you could go if you've got a question. But before we cut to that, I'd just like to give you an overview of some of the legal issues now that await in that world. Now, first are the ones that all have to do with e-commerce. And I think they'll occur to you naturally as you go through the conference today and tomorrow. If you walk into a shopping mall today and you actually go past each store, you now realize that every one of those stores has a counterpart on the World Wide Web. Every single one, from fur coats to candy to electronics, of course to software, they're all on the web. And it is so much more of a chaotic environment there. This represents, of course, a wonderful opportunity for lawyers who are going to be called upon to help structure the contracts and the deals that are going to go down, be it between a consumer and a big company, two little consumers, or even big companies as they use this environment. A second thing is to realize that to a large extent the internet is opening up a large place for the little guy. And by that I mean, because we individuals can be speakers as well as listeners on the internet, there are all sorts of opportunities for us to reach people and therefore to harm them than were ever possible before. We think of libel, we think of threats. These are things that normally, they're not meat and potatoes. They're confined to broadcasters, newspapers. I mean, generally the media has been the ones in a position to actually libel somebody, to have any reach that would raise substantial damages and about which you would need to worry. And of course the laws and rules have developed then around the idea of sophisticated parties having conflicts. CBS and General Westmoreland will go at it as to whether 60 Minutes accurately reported on the general's behavior in Vietnam. Well, now that we've got the little guy in there, and the little guy is, I don't know, Matt Drudge. He's still a little guy, but you've all heard of him. Maybe you have. Perhaps somebody can put up his page on the big screen at some point. This is a guy who works out of an apartment in Hollywood and often scoops the world media with news reports. Now, to be sure, he often also scoops them with completely false reports of things that he later retracts and apologizes for. One such thing was about Sidney Blumenthal, a White House aide in the United States, who was accused by Matt Drudge of being a wife beater. Of course, we know from the law school textbook that's the classic libel. I mean, this is a textbook case. He retracted it a little later. Blumenthal was not satisfied and has sued him for a lot of money. He has sued him for a lot of money. This is an opportunity, I suggest, on either side of the case, and I believe that if you're starting a cyber practice, more and more often, there are going to be individuals in the world who are either aggrieved by something another individual says about them, or the aggrievors of another individual, and who are going to be turning in the first instance to lawyers to help sort it out. And how to structure your representation in a case where what your client may want is not damages, but an injunction. I want them to take the site down. I want them to delete that message. Or the client may not be particularly wealthy, but really has a cause. How to structure your representation in that case, and to say, what are the rules going to be when your client happens to be local to you, but the other party is yards and miles and countries away, perhaps even in Texas, is a very good question. A third example, copyright. Now, I don't know how many of you read the paper this morning. There's a huge spread in the technology section on MP3s. This is the format that allows people at last to copy music perfectly or near perfectly, enough that you can't hear the difference, costlessly and quickly. This, of course, is thought of as a possible nightmare for the recording industry. And we've seen it repeated across one medium to another, the claim that the internet is making it so simple to copy stuff, we've got to do something. Turn to the lawyers, please turn to the legislature lawyers, and tell them they've got to do something. We've got to tighten the laws. And that has been a theme we've heard for a couple of years now. Well, I suggest that actually there's another counter theme to that. And that is that the internet of today does not necessarily resemble the internet of tomorrow. It's quite possible that tomorrow's internet will be developed by engineers who are answering not to a loose confederation of academics and military people who have particular needs, but copyright protection isn't one of them. But instead, these engineers will be answering to people who do value that. There's such a thing called copyright management systems that, when deployed, or if deployed, have the opportunity for a particular document or song to be tagged as copyrighted. And when it is, one's client, one's browser, respects that tag and actually refuses to go ahead and copy it or forward it along. Something that we've become so used to doing, just a highlight, a cut, and a paste, may not be possible in the future. And to be sure, there will always be hackers who may be able to get around whatever circumvention exists. But for most of us who aren't that, we may well be governed by that new world. And the new world of a technology that can lock up the stuff so tightly is one of amazing opportunity. Suddenly, because you can lock it up so tightly, you can sell things along dimensions and in ways that you couldn't possibly do in the real world. You could charge for the reading of a book by the view or by the page. You could charge by the person so that students get one rate to read a book and attorneys get another rate to read a book. You could imagine keeping track of who's reading what for the purposes, of course, of just being able to recommend possible other titles of interest to people at a later date. These are all possible with the technology, and again, possible futures that are not that far away. They have obvious policy ramifications, and again, I would see the role of the lawyer as realizing that, in this case, it's not a contract that will govern the relationship between the parties, because you don't need the contract. It may be that the technology will do it for you. They'll transfer their money, electronic commerce, they'll get the data back, and the software will see to it that they only use the data in the ways that the money allowed them to use it. And in that instance, designing the right rules for that exchange, rules that will be written into software code and that will bind people with far tighter enforcement than any given contract or even law, that is a wonderful challenge for the technologically minded lawyer and a great reason to imagine that the lawyer has a place in the engineering room as they are devising these systems that will transform what we normally think of as a balance of rights and responsibilities into just a disbursement of power and privilege as between the contracting parties. A final point is that of governance. This is an amazing space, the internet, and figuring out just how it's going to be centrally coordinated for those functions that we have reason to think need central coordination, domain name's a great example, is an enduring question, and one that calls for lawyers as constitutionalists, as applied philosophers, to help find out the right answers. There are meetings taking place right now in which these issues are being discussed and ultimately decided. Again, in the domain name example, a new organization called the International Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, ICANN, is private, it's nonprofit, it was formed at the behest of an international process wanting not to have any one sovereign, not to have any one government run things. They've formed ICANN, which is not a treaty organization. It's just a group of 9 people right now. They're not sure how these people were picked. I'm not making this up. One of the first tasks of these 9 people is to figure out how to choose their successors in a way that reflects accountability to the wide internet community. And what is the internet community? But basically everybody. The meetings in which this happens are ones that are open and that welcome participation by anybody who sees fit to show up there. And I would suggest that you might want to consider looking into this and seeing, is this a place where wonderful opportunity for me to learn about the internet and at the same time imagine cutting my teeth on some of the practice issues of governance that are going to come about tomorrow. And just as global coordination of the internet may be a question, so too is governance and coordination of the little communities, the so-called distinct societies that comprise the internet as we know it and are likely to know it in the future. So with that said, it's with great joy that I have the privilege of opening this conference, of hopefully raising some questions that as we get into the nitty-gritty, into the details that are the little issues that matter so much over the course of the next day or two, I hope you share with me the excitement of that. And with that, I'd love to entertain any questions there might be. Thank you. If somebody has a hand up, there's absolutely no way I can see it. So marching to the microphone is the way to go, I would think. Wow, thank you very much.
I told you he was fun.
Jonathan, just before you leave, I wanted to thank you on behalf of the Planning Committee and offer you up a small token of our appreciation. And I'll assure you that it's not a nice sculpture.
Thank you very much. As long as it's not ticking. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right. Our next panel, please.
We have about 2 or 3 minutes before we, while we set up our next panel, if anybody wants to get a cup of coffee or... Also, there are a number of people who are standing at the sides and at the back. There are some empty chairs up here at the front on this side of the room if people would like to come and sit down. Information which we need to bring under management is increasing, not simply because there are more of us and we're creating more information, but because technology is making more and more of it available through networking technology and the internet and so on. We have 3 presentations this morning from 3 people who have a view and some interesting lessons relating to this topic. The first is Gerard Power, who has recently assumed the position of General Counsel and Corporate Secretary at Canada Post. In addition to being responsible for a decentralized law department with 23 lawyers, he reports to the chairman and president and chief executive officer, and has a variety of other significant responsibilities for that large Canadian corporation. We also have Michael Geist, who's an assistant professor of law at the University of Ottawa Law School. Michael is the creator and author of the Michael Geist Web Lecture Series on the LexisNexis Legal Education website. He holds a Bachelor of Laws from Osgoode Hall Law School, was a graduate legal research scholar in Japan, has obtained a Master of Laws in Commercial Law and European Union Law at the University of Cambridge, is a Master of Laws from Columbia Law School in New York, and is presently a Doctor of Juridical Science candidate at Columbia Law School in New York. We also have Tim Boma, who's a product strategist for PC Docs Fulcrum, which is a well-known industry-leading software vendor specializing in knowledge management solutions, some of which are on display in the Wired office. Tim's extensive experience in knowledge management, especially as it pertains to how technology provides value to customers, gives him a good perspective on some of these issues. So with this introduction, I'd like to turn it over to Gerard to move ahead.
In keeping with the dynamic nature of our practice, Michael, Tim and I have decided that the way our presentations work, it would be best if Michael were to start first.
Looks like I'm back on.
Yes. Sorry. I need to...
All right, as we're reconnecting, I might as well get started. And actually, one of the first caveats that I was going to offer for my presentation today was that one of the first rules people tell you about making presentations about the internet is not to try to do it live. This is why. invariably things can go wrong, and hopefully we'll get things rectified and things will work out well here. But it provides an important lesson for the things that I